NetCredit is here to say yes, because you're more than a credit score. Apply in minutes and get a decision as soon as the same day. Loans offered by NetCredit or lending partner banks and serviced by NetCredit. Application subject to review and approval. Learn more at netcredit.com/partners. NetCredit. Credit to the people.
The Last Word on Today FM.
Now, you're very welcome back. It is time for the Culture Club. I'm delighted to say this legendary broadcaster, Dave Fanning, is here with me. Dave, how are you getting on?
Well, how are you doing? I'm getting on very well. Legendary, well. Wow.
It's as fair as I can be. Long tenured broadcaster, well, whatever way you want to put it. Tell us about the show on Virgin Media now. You're into season number 5 now at this stage, John. Fanning's of Whelan's, and you've got some of the best musicians from the country back for this series.
Well, yeah, what it is really just it's like a potpourri of who's out there at the moment, because a lot of it's up and coming, a lot of it's new, and then some of them are well established, and that's the way it goes all the time. So in other words, like, it goes out on Saturday night at 10 o'clock, it's repeated every Thursday night around 11 or so, and that's really what it is. So there's usually, like, there's three parts of the programme. Part one is three live acts, part two, three is three live acts, and the middle bit is somebody comes in and talks about their favourite music, and that's it.
Were you inspired kind of by the Jules Holland style format for this, or?
Not necessarily. What we were inspired by was somebody coming to me, would you do something? You're supposed to be the one for Irish bands. COVID's happening. They're all dying. They're all leaving the country. They're all going back to work. The factories are shut. They're all going back to work in the offices. Oh, wait, the offices. Like, they can't do anything. So we got in touch with Whelan's. Diageo were brilliant. They've always said they put money into the thing. So it's Guinness and Whelan's and myself. And it was meant to be maybe, I don't know, for a couple of years. And it's just been successful enough to keep it going. So what it is about 24 acts in each series. And there's about 7 or 8 programmes in each series.
Yeah, because it's tricky enough for acts to get themselves out there right now. The noise is probably a lot bigger than it would have been 25, 30 years ago.
To be honest, it's impossible. It's getting really, really difficult. It's getting 10 times more hard than it ever used to be. It's terrible. It really isn't just... bands need every help they can get. Acts that are starting off... Like, at least 5 or 6 of the acts on this current series have their first album released this year in 2024. Some of them haven't even got that far. Some of them, Villages are on the 7th, you know. There's a bunch of them, like, who are very famous, you know, and who are well on the road. So it's a mix of them all, you know.
Yeah, it's a chance maybe to open the door for some of the newer acts.
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
To get them to perform live as well, I suppose that opportunity has maybe dropped off a little bit now. Like, I mean, I think of maybe other voices where bands can get on and get a chance to perform, but there's maybe not that many TV shows these days that will now bring a band into play.
It's not even to do with TV shows. Like, I mean, people have a certain amount of money that they'll spend on going to see a band live, and unfortunately, almost all of that money is going on the huge acts. And once you're huge, people, like, I mean... You know, once the gig is announced at Croke Park, people want to go. You know, it doesn't matter who's playing, kind of thing. The big gigs, the Three Arena and all that, they're like a million miles away from so many of the gigs that really count in terms of where the bands all used to start or where it all happens at first. And it's a shame, really, you know.
This Saturday, you've Imelda May coming on.
Yeah, she's talking about her favourite music. Yeah, she's very passionate about what we've just been talking about the fact that there's talent out there, but there isn't enough kind of, if you like, of a stage for them necessarily to play on. There's not enough push.
Yeah, and I would think as well it's difficult for them to make an income out of all this because, as you say, there are going to be a handful of artists who do particularly well from streaming and from Spotify and everything else, but yet...
A handful, not like compared to whatever. Like, I mean, I think it was 3 years ago, 90,000 new songs were put up on YouTube or something every day. Now it's 120,000 every day. So, like, you know, it's lap of the gods. But that's one thing that hasn't changed, actually. Talent or no talent, luck is still 80% of it. It really is. And for those who make it through, it's great, but most don't.
Would... Bono and you too have found it far more difficult to break through now.
Oh, no question about it. You can say, hey, but they're really talented. That's not the way. Like, I mean, they had great management. They had, like, Paul McGuinness looking after them to do exactly the right thing. I remember meeting the lead singer of U2 on Grafton Street once, like all the other bands. He goes, yeah, we're going over to London. I went, yeah, great. Okay, every band goes to London. Okay, great. Good luck, you know. No doubt, 50% chance of being broken up by Christmas, because that's what it used to happen. They weren't going to London, though. They were using London as a stepping stone. They were always going to America. And they got Premier Talent, which was Springsteen's thing. They got Frank Barcelona. They got the right kind of people. And all of that has to be working at the same time. And they got as far as 3 albums, and then they got to 15 albums or whatever, you know, obviously, because the talent did out in their case, you know.
Is it still a massive passion for you listening to new acts when they arrive in? I'm sure they come in probably by email now as opposed to...
Funny enough, yeah. In other words, people say, do you still get demo tapes? You get more than ever because all they have to do is press the button and everybody gets it in one go. Yeah, it's pretty frightening. I mean, the whole way of even listening to music is just kind of... The journey is gone. You don't have to earn that money at Christmas to make more money to buy an album. Like, years ago, you'd have a guy who got so-and-so's album and you'd kind of... He lived 3 miles away. You'd cycle over to hear it, no problem. You know, now we just press the button and every single thing is there. Is that a good thing? I don't think it is, no.
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to romanticise the past, but we were kind of talking about the studios have changed here in Marconi House, but I can't remember when I started out in radio. It was definitely a time when the music companies would send in a bunch of CDs.
Yeah.
And one of your music directors would literally sit down, put a set of cans on, and maybe listen to a load of singles that have just arrived in.
Yeah.
I think that might be slightly different now.
Do you know?
Just a bit.
Absolutely. The whole thing is like so homogenisedly, computerisedly, you know. Oh, it's just terrible. I don't know. It's just not the way it should be in some way. Like, it's just that you don't really go to people's houses now to listen to a new album, do you?
No, that's true.
Then again, you can listen to music all day now and take your choice, take your pick from whatever's there, you know.
That's it. Right? I do somewhat miss the day, though, when like your friend could make a mixtape or a mix CD and hand it out, and that's the way you found out about
it. One of the most important things, the amount of girlfriends and boyfriends that got together because of those things, yeah, absolutely.
And then you found yourself going to a gig, and then you might go to a gig because you like someone that was on the warm-up acts, yeah. And then it kind of just recycles its way around.
I mean, I saw a band 2 weeks ago at the Workman's Club on a Sunday night, and they just come back from an Irish tour. And they had played 5 or 6 dates, and like they must have lost money because like there's 5 or 6 of the band, bed and breakfast, travel, you know, food and all that. It's just not easy. It really isn't, you know. And there's no great kind of goal at the end in terms of like what it used to be, get a record deal. Because once they've got a record deal, the record companies underwrote tours and studio and all that. So I suppose I could say, well, listen, hard luck. Still go out there and do it, you know.
Yeah. Let's get on to your choices then. I'm sure picking the music was probably particularly difficult on this one.
Well, no, because it's so whatever. I mean, I guarantee if I was on this programme again next week, these answers could all be different. And that's the way it always goes, you know? Yeah, really. Yeah.
Okay, well, the first one is the first single, and I presume these are the first singles that you ever purchased. Yeah. So, Penny Lane by the Beatles or The Moody Blues and Go Now. The Beatles are going to come up again. Maybe a different era of the Beatles in a few minutes' time. But what attracted you as a young man towards the Moody Blues then?
Well, no, it was just that track. I mean, I was very young. I don't know what it was, 8 or 9 or whatever. And it's just, first of all, Denny Lane's vocals I find amazing. Also, the song is all over the place. I think it starts with a chorus, but maybe it doesn't, which is very unusual. Like, you could Dancing Queen by ABBA. You could count in your hand, one hand, how many songs start with the chorus. And I don't know, it's just, there's something about the whole thing. Like, he went on to actually be with the Beatles later on. Well, I'm sorry, be with Paul McCartney and Wings later on. But there's something about the vocals and the whole thing. There's a lovely piano solo then in the middle. And also around the same time as House of the Rising Sun by the Animals. They're just really like amazing pieces of magic jumping out of your transistor at the time every 15 minutes. And that was just one at the time. And I really wanted it as a kid. Having said that, I was the youngest of 6.
Right.
So I might have even bought something earlier if I'd ever got the money. But I always was able to steal it off my brothers who were able to buy stuff.
Was music huge among your parents and siblings then?
Parents. My father had one. In fact, my father had one album.
Right.
I'll tell you, it's an amazing.
Nope, it was a good one.
No, it's amazing about the. No, it was the. Well, it was brilliant. Yes, Brendan O'Dowda sings the songs of Percy French. He played it every year on Christmas Day. It's the only time he was allowed near the record player. But the funny thing about it is, like, I remember watching a football match. I watched football quite a lot on TV. It was some second division or third division match, and I don't even know what team it was. And you know, the ball to O'Dowda, and I went, O'Dowda, that's a weird name. I said, I wonder. It's his grandson. He plays for Ireland. He plays for Ireland these days. It's Brendan O'Dowda's grandson or something. The brothers were huge. I mean, the oldest brother of all was like a lot of jazz and stuff. And then all these box sets came in of Woody Guthrie and like very early Dylan and you know all that sort of stuff. Big, huge music house. And then the one just above me, the brother Jared Fanning, he's the poet and he like had everything. I mean, the incredible string band. I learned so much from him.
That sounds like it rubbed off on you as the youngest brother. Yeah, Sometimes the youngest brother will rebel against.
Are you joking me? My taste rubbed off on them. I was in it as quick as I could play a record player.
Found its way up the ladder. Penny Lane then by the Beatles. Well, off on the first.
Yeah, Penny Lane and Strawberry. You see, Penny Lane and Strawberry Fields Forever were a double-sided single, yeah, which bizarrely for the Beatles at that stage did not get to number one. Famously, Engelbert Humperdinck came out. And being number one was very important. But like the two of them together, you buy Penny Lane, it's the pop single and all that, etc. But the B-side of that opened complete doors for me. They had a song on an album, which was one of the previous albums. It was called Tomorrow Never Knows. That was weird. Well, it was Penny, Strawberry Fields Forever. That was weird. And I realised, weird is brilliant. To hell with this pop stuff.
Tomorrow Never Knows always stands out for me because it re-popped up again because of Mad Men a few years ago.
Oh, was it? Yeah.
So the storyline was in Mad Men, it was you can do things cheaper, you can do it right.
Right.
And apparently the producers of Mad Men, it was kind of a bit of an inside joke as well, had to pay a fool's ransom to actually be able to use the Beatles in the series as well.
Yeah. And turn off your mind and relax and float downstream.
An amazing song.
Yeah, yeah, it really is. Yeah, but I mean, these two anyway, like Penny Lane, the fact that it was a double A-side thing, and even the single didn't have a hole in the middle of it as you buy it. It had a full picture of the Beatles and they were in the moustache mode. Not that I think moustaches are great necessarily, but, you know, it was pretty cool since it was the Beatles.
Yeah, possibly more creative a phase for them at the time as well.
Yeah.
It brings us around to favourite album then. So there's a few contenders here.
Oh, wow.
So this is obviously a difficult one. And I knew the White Album by the Beatles was going to come up when we were talking about Tomorrow Never Knows as well. So what did you like about the White Album? Because I remember my uncle growing up, like, argued it was much better than their pop material. That this
I happen to like white albums. I like double albums.
Okay.
I like albums that have too much stuff on it. I like albums that even have one or two bad songs, but you really find yourself going, like Exile on Main Street would be the best Rolling Stones album, or London Calling, The Clash, that kind of thing. So I do like kind of extra stuff, or Rattling Home. That'd be one of my favourite U2 albums, although it wouldn't be for a lot of people. And in this case here, there's just so much stuff on it. I mean, to be honest, listening to some of it now, which I did recently, some of it is tame enough. It really is. You know, some of the Ringo stuff and even the George stuff, like Savoy Truffle and stuff, is awful. But it was just cool. It was cool at the time, and that's one of the things I loved about it.
So would you argue, if you're their manager, you would have been more selective about what they actually stuck on it?
Well, I mean, they're so good and they have so many great things. I mean, there's a song on it called Revolution 9, which at the time was absolute rubbish. Don't worry, over time it'll get better. It got worse. It's absolutely appalling. It's just a total waste of time, and it's not avant-garde anything as it was. I mean, like as John Lennon even himself said, what does avant-garde mean? He said, avant-garde a clue. But I mean, the thing is, it's just awful. I mean, I could think of about five tracks in that are terrible. Having said that, it's a great album.
Bob Dylan was going to get in here.
Yeah, so, well, Bob
Blonde and Blonde.
You see, the thing is, the Blonde and Blonde White Album around the same time, and you're very impressionable at that age and whatever it is, and they're the things you think most, you know, because like you go back to those all the time. Obviously, Blonde and Blonde was the end of an 18-month period, which is just like bizarre. There was Highway 61 Revisited, and there was Bringing It All Back Home before that, and then Blonde and Blonde, and it just kept churning out from the guy, and just got better and better all the time. Like one whole side of, again, a double album is Sad Eye Lady, The Lowlands, and it's just perfect. But there's lots, like there's Visions of Johanna and all those songs on it as well. My favourite on it is probably The Fourth Time Around is what it's called. But I mean, I think if I had to just pick one album, which you're asking me to pick, then I would have to go to an album basically by an Irish band. Well, certainly the main guys and the main two from 1991. It's the second of three albums from My Bloody Valentine. It's called Loveless.
All right.
Absolutely love it.
Let's take a little bit of My Bloody Valentine then. Go When You Sleep by My Bloody Valentine. What do you like about My Bloody Valentine?
The noise.
Right.
I mean, like, I've never come across anything like that in my life. The guy spent a fortune on it. He bankrupted a record company making it. There's all sorts of stories. They'd had an album out before that called Isn't Anything, and this was the end of everything. The guys from Creation just went mad, and it was worth every penny. It's like an album from a different planet. Mm. And there's a song on it called Sometimes, which used to play on the radio all the time. I never played it once. It was always back to back. So it was 5 minutes. I always played 10 minutes because you have to hear it twice. It's just like everything about it. It's the noises off it. It's what just happens there. It's from a different world. It's like as though it's been posted in from somewhere else. And it usually does very well. I'm quite surprised in one way, in all sorts of lists of favourite albums and all that. And rightly so. Loveless from 1991. They released one more, finally, about 20 years later in 2013, called MBV. And there's some pretty good stuff on that too. And they're actually playing. They're coming back to play, which is huge. On, I think it's November 25th, is it, or something, in 2025?
Yeah,
it's
till end of next year, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And I've seen them live twice. Saw them at one of the festivals. They were pretty good. I saw them at SFX in Dublin. I was at Vicar Street. No, it was SFX. And I thought it was dreadful. I mean, for about 9 minutes, a Kango Hammer would have been more kind of tuneful. But that's what they do, you know. So, you know, whatever it is. Brilliant. Just brilliant.
Brings her a nice to
Kevin Shields from Dublin.
Yeah, your favourite gig. So you've gone with The Clash here.
Well, no, yeah, it's easy to say that because you see, like, when punk happened and then I saw The Clash at Trinity College and everybody went, wasn't that fantastic? And I thought, well, actually, no, I thought it was terrible. Like, I loved the first album, but the gig was sloppy and obviously. That's supposed to be a plus point, you know, because it's punk.
I'm going to assume, is this outdoors,
no,
Trinity?
No. It was indoors in Trinity in some exam hall that was never built for a gig. And of course, people say, yeah, but isn't that anarchic? And no, that's just not very good. And I even remember the support band. God, I've suddenly forgotten. But anyway, then 2 years later, they were kind of, after giving them enough rope, by the third album, London Calling, it was just catching a band at a moment. It was the one kind of 10 minutes in their life that I knew they were going to be good. And they were amazing. Just, what was it again? Was it even the music? It was just the energy. It was the vibe. It was the thing. It was, and like, I mean, did I see them somewhere really exotic, like Buenos Aires? No, the top hat in Dunleary. And it was, and that's now, that turned into a kid's play thing. And now it's a block of flats. But it was brilliant. It was just right, because they were promoting London Calling.
Was there a bit of a punk culture in Dublin in the late 70s?
Oh my God,
yeah.
Oh my God, yeah. I mean, I remember, like, Advance Records there in South King Street, the man with his jacket, sort of, you know, help your local police, beat yourself up, written on the back, this kind of stuff. There was lots of stuff, yeah, there was loads. I mean, I was doing all sorts of stuff in McGonagall's and all that. There was punk stuff everywhere, and there was just energetic stuff everywhere. I mean, some of it kind of was slightly pub rocky. It just came from kind of, like, you know, I don't know, Hatfield in the North kind of stuff, or the Dr. Feelgood into the Boomtown Rats and that. But there was plenty of punk stuff around, yeah, really good, like Paranoid Visions and stuff.
You said the Top Hat's not what it was. It's obviously changed out. What was it like as a venue back then?
It was the same as I mean, there was the Olympic Ballroom and there was the SFX and, you know, there was, you can imagine what it was like. It wasn't exactly purpose-built for what we wanted, you know, but it was fine. It was perfect.
It was perfect for what it was.
Balcony around the side and that. And yeah. It was just, I don't know, there was something about Mick Jones on the guitar, something about Joe Strummer doing his thing, and it was just perfect. It really was, you know.
All right. Dave Fang's going to stay with me. This is The Culture Club on The Last Word. When we come back, we'll be taking a look at his favourite movies. We'll be taking a look at literature as well. We'll be back in a minute. Good to go. Now, you're very welcome back. It is The Culture Club here on The Last Word. Dave Fanning is here with me. We've been talking about very much home territory for him, talking about music before. And let's get an insight maybe into some other areas here, Dave. Let's take a look at movies here. So the movies you had in contention, before we get to what could potentially be your favourite, there's quite a mix here. So we've got Secrets and Lies, we've got Nashville, and we've got one of the great horrors in Psycho as well.
Yeah, and I could have put The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance in there as well. Mm. Because, like, I need about 20 years to before I start saying, so, like, what's the best one of this century? I saw a great one the other day called My Big Ass. Seriously, check it out.
What's My Big Ass? This sounds worrying, but go on.
Oh, My Big Ass is about a girl growing up on a cranberry farm in Canada. It's a beautiful movie about kind of, you know, coming of age. And basically one night something happens and she's sitting beside her 39-year-old self. I know that sounds ridiculous. Mm. Aubrey Plaza plays the 39-year-old. And it's just, it's not a body swap thing or anything like that, but it's just her growing up with her. Actually, she's got two brothers in this, and one of them, the younger brother, has an obsession. You know what his obsession is? Saoirse Ronan. He's got Saoirse Ronan pictures all over his house and his wall. But it's actually really good. It's a lovely, it's just a nice movie. But anyway, sorry, good movies, great movies. I can think of a thousand and a million, obviously. But I mean, yeah, I suppose if I had to pick one, it would be Nashville, because it, again, that hit me at a certain time. I was maybe about 20, and it's Robert Altman. There's no major person, like, sorry, there's 24 people in the movie, and they all have equal billing. And it's just one or two days in the life of Nashville, the music town. There's plenty of music in it. In fact, I don't, country music isn't my thing, but I went out and bought the album and I love it. And most of the actors wrote their own songs. It's kind of really weird. It's very loose and very odd movie of just, I don't know what you'd call it. And there's a political rally going on in the background all the time as well. It's just America, and it's really, really good.
Yeah, it's fierce. I've seen it. I know there's a great ensemble cast
as
well.
Yeah, that's it, yeah. I mean, Secrets and Lies from the 90s will be my movie, because I love that Mike Leigh stuff and that. It's just a powerful movie of people not connecting and not getting on and not being able to express what it is that's wrong with themselves, and it just explodes with the main guy then later on. It's so well done. Timothy Spall and all the rest of them. It's really great. Again, ensemble. And then you say Psycho. Yeah, Psycho and The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance would be 60s for me. Psycho, I'll never forget, I'd seen The Birds. And I thought, I'm not scared of this. I could take anything from Alfred Hitchcock. And, like, you know, obviously I was 5 years younger than you were supposed to be going into it. And so I did. Mother of jeepers, it scared the whatever out of me. And you realise it's great. Like, I don't particularly go for horror movies necessarily much, which is probably the biggest genre in Hollywood in the last 20 years. But there's just something about it. It's powerful, visceral, my God, you know. And, like, the things that happen. Number one, the main person in the movie, I mean, she's going along doing her thing and that. And then, I'm not giving anything away, it's 60.
I think you can give a spoiler 50
okay.
years on, yeah.
Oh, yeah, exactly. I mean, like, she gets murdered. And, like, you know, it's like, after 20 minutes, that never happens in a movie.
Especially when it's the big Hollywood actress as well, you just don't expect it.
Yeah, Vivian Leigh, like, what's going to happen now? You know, Marion Crane was her name in the movie. But, like, it's just, I saw it about 11 times. The seventh time I saw it, all I saw was the music. Bernard Herrmann's score. There's one scene where she gets a chance to possibly steal a lot of money because the boss really trusts her and she's off to the bank to put the money in. Friday afternoon, if I go off now, 3 days before it's Monday, damn it, I'll steal the money. So she does. And she's in the car with the money and she's at the traffic lights. And the boss walks across the thing and says, oh, look, wait a minute, I thought she said she was sick and going home to bed. And the music just goes, and it's like, whoa, you're thrown back in the cinema. And it's just fantastic.
It's one of those kind of iconic soundtracks as well, where even when it's in parody, obviously, so many times now because it's such an iconic movie.
Yeah.
But even, you know, the sounds and the shrieks from the shower, it's just, it's gone into culture
the
now.
The shower, it was absolutely shocking. You know, it's just really kind of weird. But there's so many good bits in the movie. The way the camera goes up on the ceiling as Martin Balsam walks up the stairs, and you just know this is not going to work out very well, you know?
Yeah.
It's so good.
Let's take a little bit from Psycho here.
No, I tell you, no. I won't have you bringing strange young girls in for supper. By candlelight, I suppose, in the cheap erotic fashion of young men with cheap erotic minds.
Mother, please.
And then what? After supper, music? Whispers?
Mother, she's just a stranger. She's hungry and it's raining out.
Mother, she's just a stranger. As if men don't desire strangers. As if... Oh, I refuse to speak of disgusting things because they disgust me. You understand, boy? Go on, go tell her she'll not be appeasing her ugly appetite with my food or my son. Or do I have to tell her because you don't have the guts? Huh, boy? You have the guts, boy?
Shut up! Shut up!
I've caused you some trouble.
No, mother, my mother, what is the phrase? She isn't quite herself today.
You see, I'll give away my age here, whereby I remember this kind of backwards. So obviously that scene gets parodied in The Simpsons, where it's principals, it's Seymour Skinner.
No, that's ruined.
Yeah, talking to his mother, and you're not quite sure if he is quite Norman Bates or not. Yeah. People are listening into him talking.
Excellent. So. Yeah, that's him walking back and she's eating the sandwiches, the taxidermy on the wall is brilliant.
Fantastic, fantastic clip.
Yeah.
Director, before we get on to actor here, you've already mentioned Mike Leigh, obviously, is a director who's close to your heart.
Yeah, because there's something about the he makes movies in England, English characters. He's made a lot of good names like Alison Steadman and Gary Oldman and Jane Horrocks and Brenda Blethyn and all these people. And he works with all these people and you think, okay, another one from him. Oh yeah, okay, this might be. Every time I see one, I'm surprised at how good it is, which is really kind of stupid. Like Vera Drake or Happy Go Lucky was lovely with the driving test one. Another Year was brilliant. Topsy Turvy. I absolutely loved Topsy Turvy, which came out around 1999. And it's kind of about, you know, the stage musicals, really, which was, you know, which isn't what the movie's about. It's just about the two people making them. And Life is Sweet and Naked. But Secrets and Lies is the one for me. It's all, as I say, a bit like me now, very difficult to express the feelings that people have and they're not able to do it right. And it just, things go wrong and things aren't right and that. But it's absolutely, he paints great pictures.
You've picked an actor here who has got one of the widest CVs probably in Hollywood. In Gene Hackman. What do you love about Gene Hackman?
Again, it's just, I just think of Gene Hackman. I was only thinking of him the other day. As I say, I might give a different answer next week, like Tom Hardy or something, or anybody. But there's something about Gene Hackman. I always love the fact that he didn't seem to give a damn about things. And people say, I know the people who worked with him said he was great. And that kind of, you know, like, I like that kind of thing, you know. I mean, Mississippi Burning or Bonnie and Clyde or, you know, The French Connection, obviously, Scarecrow. You know, movies like Runaway Jury, even smaller movies than that. He's just got a presence that I like, where he kind of doesn't take any, you know what, you know.
Yeah, and again, a guy who transcended decade after decade after decade and probably was able to reinvent himself ever so slightly from kind of those gangster movies in the 70s.
Yeah, but also he became a writer, I think, didn't he? Or something.
Yeah, he's really great.
He became injured and started writing books or something. Yeah, he hasn't had a movie for 20 years, but he's brilliant.
Yeah, that brings us around to books. Why not have a look at your favourite author then? So David Hepworth, why?
Well, actually, my favourite author is actually, believe it or not, my brother who passed away a few years ago has a lot of books of poetry out, five books, and his wife, Breedon Quillen, brilliantly put the whole thing together as one single collection. And only last week in Books Upstairs in town there in Dalier Street, there was a great launch about the Irish Times literary guy and everybody else. And it was really good. So it's Gerard Fanning's collected poetry. And it's all, I'm only saying it because when his books came out, but now that it's all together, and not just that I can relate to all the holidays in Bettystown in it or all the movies. He's a huge movie guy and all the rest. He's even got his name on the seat in the IFI, all that kind of. But it's just, I could really get into it all. But no, the name I did put down was David Hepworth. Only because, like, I've just read his latest one, which is Hope I Don't Die Before I Get Old, which is a play on the Who song. And he's always writing about music. He writes about, and he has a wry eye, if you could have that. You know, he's got a way of looking at it. Like, I mean, the best example would be the book about 1971 being the best year in rock. It's brilliant the way he doesn't give an opinion. He's saying 1971 is the best year for rock, and this is why. Like, you're a fool if you don't believe me. And you're halfway through the book and you go, God, he's got a point. You know? And I just like the way he does it, you know.
Yeah, well, as you say, play on names and play on songs. Uncommon People by David Hepworth. Have a listen.
There are still people who dress like rock stars and do their best to act as they think rock stars would have acted in an earlier time, much as there are people who strap on replica holsters and reenact the gunfight at the OK Corral. It's increasingly difficult to act like one or the other and keep a straight face. The true rock stars rose and fell with the fortunes of the post-war record industry. They came along in the mid-50s and they passed away in the last decade of the century just gone. We came to know them as rock stars, but at first, they had no generic name. In the early days, when Elvis Presley, Fats Domino and the like were coming out of nowhere, they might as easily have been called hillbilly cats, rhythm and blues shouters, specialists in western bop, plain pop singers, or promoters of dance crazes. The term rock star really came into widespread use in the 70s and 80s, when the music business was looking to sustain the careers of its biggest names.
I can see why you enjoy what he writes about.
Ah, yeah, he's got a way, you know, and I find myself agreeing with an awful lot of what he says. That kind of helps, you know.
For the next one, I'm going to play the clip first before we talk about it, because this could have been one of two different versions, but you have picked The Office, but the UK version of The Office.
Yeah, and I get all this, oh, David, you know, you're a brilliant singer-songwriter. You're stuck in Slough, while it's Texas that are off, you know, making all the money And they're rubbish compared to you. And I go, don't slag them off. I say, I've been there, I've done that. You know, that's behind me. You know, and I, you know, I respect. Thing is, we're both good in our own fields. I'm sure Texas couldn't run and manage a successful paper merchants. Yeah, I couldn't, you know, do what. Actually, I could do what they do, and I think they knew that even back then. Probably what spurred them on. I wrote this. I only play songs I've written myself. So.
You went home to get it.
Spaceman came down to answer some things. The world gathered round from paupers to kings. I'll answer your questions, I'll answer them true. I'll show you the way, you know what to do. Who is wrong and who is right? Yellow, brown, black or white? The spaceman, he answered, you no longer mind. I've opened your eyes, you're now colorblind.
I do like that Tim points out that he had to drive home to get the guitar to bring it in.
Yeah, and he has to say it out loud. I mean, it, like, of all the things you've asked me here, there's never anything I would answer next week or the week after that wouldn't be that. It is like, I mean, normally you're a certain age and it gets you exactly at a certain age of the greatest thing ever. But like, I was like twice the age of normal here when this thing happened. I actually went into it the right way because I had no idea. I saw it for the first 10 minutes one night and I thought, this is a documentary, but it's very weird. These people are a bit kind of odd, you know. I actually fell for a hook, line and sinker because at that time, around 2000, there wasn't that kind of stuff.
Oh, the spoof documentary didn't exist.
And
yeah.
It is the greatest TV programme, Barn. I'm going to do a David Hepworth on this. This is the greatest TV programme ever. Now, the terrible thing is I haven't really seen the American one. I believe it's very good.
Yeah.
I believe it's good. But this is just the nuance, the sly little bits, everything about it is just fantastic. The way it's filmed, the reaction shots.
Is it helped by the fact it was short as well?
Well, funny you should say that, because it was short. It was six programmes and then six programmes. Then I heard they were going to do a Christmas special. I went, no, they're going to ruin it. The Christmas special was gorgeous.
The movie never happened, by the way.
Good, yeah.
The
okay. Yeah, no, but the Christmas special was absolutely perfect. And one of the things is, like in The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance, you think it's just kind of a Western. There's a thing in the middle of it, which most people don't necessarily know, which is a fantastically written love story. And Tim and Don in this, what a fantastic love story. And then at the end, when the taxi stops and she opens the present and says, never give up, and she goes back, oh my God, it's fantastic. Everything about that programme is brilliant. Ricky Gervais, I mean, we need him, and we need him more than ever now, I can tell you.
It ends perfectly, even him standing up to Finchie in the last episode. That's why
standing up to Finchie, and I can't use the language he used, but just he just looks at him, says it, and walks away. It's like, yes! Everything about the programme, there's nothing wrong with it. Like, the whole idea of half looking at a camera and not, and the camera's there, oh God, now it's good. And he's always pulling his tie down like this when he gets embarrassed. It's just everything. When he steps out from behind the desk with the big emu, oh my God. And they're just the visual jokes. Fantastic. I've got two bits of good news, or two bits of news, one good. I've got promoted, you got sacked.
You got sacked. Yeah.
I can think of it. Anyway, like if I'm ever doom scrolling through YouTube, I find myself always going back to clips, best clips, worst clips, any clips from The Office, bits left out. It's fantastic.
In the minute that we have left, we can go through your buried treasure here. So what you've put in here, you've put in Rock and Roll with the Modern Lovers by Jonathan Richman. You've got the Ramones, Leave Home, or potentially Morning Phase by Beckner.
Yeah, I picked Morning Phase.
Well.
I want to pick something from the last 10 years. Without a doubt, Morning Phase, there's a certain thing about the Morning Phase album. It's a real morning album by Beck. I just absolutely love it. But yeah, I mean, Rock and Roll with the Modern Lovers from 1977. Most people don't know it, and it's great.
Dave, it's been a pleasure. Thanks so many for joining us for the Culture Club.
Thank you. The Last Word on Today FM.